Greetings and anniversarial tribulations, my stupendously omnivarious listeners, and welcome to this July 2014 Science News Update. I'm your host for this loverly science podcast, Jim Campanella. In this wonderfully hot month of July, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, we celebrate the sixth anniversary of this science podcast segment. Yay! Before I start to get maudlin here, I better start with some actual science. The first two stories of the night coincidentally involve hair. I have no idea why. I guess it's just one of those months for synchronicity. First, Dr. David Kingsley of Stanford University and his research group report in the June issue of Nature Genetics that they have finally found the genetic basis of blonde hair. Kingsley's goal was not originally to examine where blonde hair comes from. He was actually motivated by how complex traits arise in natural populations. He started out investigating how three-spined stickleback fish evolved new skin colors in different environments. But all of his fish studies kept turning up a variant in a genomic region upstream of the human KIT protein gene, which was associated with hair color. From experiments done in tissue culture and test tubes, Kingsley's group learned that this genetic variant he kept seeing appeared in a DNA enhancer region. Now, a DNA enhancer is a regulatory sequence that has the ability to modulate just how active gene expression may be. Usually, enhancers turn the expression of a gene up. Sometimes the sequence will not necessarily be an enhancer. It'll actually turn the activity of the gene downward. In this case, the enhancer sequence controlled the level of expression of the KIT protein gene, rather than just turning it on and off. In fact, Kingsley found that the blonde variant of the enhancer dials the gene's expression down by 20%. Now, that's only 20% compared with the ancestral brunette version. That is kind of like turning down the volume of your television set or your radio just a smidge and not turning it off entirely. To figure out exactly what the gene was doing, Kingsley moved his studies into mouse models, particularly a mouse expressing the blonde enhancer sequence and others expressing the ancestral sequence. Kingsley inserted a single copy blonde enhancer into a specific place on the chromosome. It turned out that once he did this, the mice with the blonde enhancer sequence, well, all their offspring became blonde. On this result, Kingsley said, quote, "The study was beautifully and rigorously performed with an elegant use of mouse models, shedding light on an important human regulatory variant. We demonstrate that genetic alterations will deliver blonde hair color with as little as a single base pair change in DNA." Unquote. Kingsley next plans to unpack more of the regulatory regions surrounding the KIT protein gene, which is also involved in the development of skin cells, blood cells, and germ cells, and has been linked to cancer. Okay, so a minor variation of the regulatory sequence of a single developmental gene can give you blonde hair. What other things interest us about hair? I guess the number one interest on the list of hair in most men would be hair loss and how to keep from losing your hair. But genetics can play nasty tricks on people, and hair loss is only one of the problems you can have with hair. What about hair overgrowth? That is the developmental tendency to grow not just too much hair, but in addition to that, hair in places where there should be no hair. Dr. Angela Cristiano and her research group from Columbia University decided that too much time and money was being spent on hair loss and not enough on genetic conditions that cause hair overgrowth. She says, quote, "There are not many groups around the world that study hair biology in general, and even fewer study hair overgrowth," unquote. Cristiano presents her new data on this problem in the May issue of PLOS Genetics. The condition of hypertrichosis is characterized by lots of hair growing where it shouldn't. For example, there might be terminal, that is, thick, dark, dense hairs growing on the forearm of a child, where vellum, which is fine, light, short hairs, should be growing. Previously, Cristiano had discovered broad genetic problems in people who have this disorder, such as gene copy numbers or variants of the genes and or chromosomal arrangements of those genes or the areas around the genes. This time, she decided to study a single case of congenital generalized hypertrichosis terminalis, which is shortened to CGHT. The parents of the affected person were not affected, indicating that the disorder was inherited in a recessive manner and that the parents were just carriers of the mutant gene. To find the gene involved, Cristiano sequenced the genomes of the patient and then both parents. Her analysis uncovered variants in 26 genes that were homozygous in the patient and heterozygous in both parents. A literature review narrowed the field down to 3 genes, and then analysis of hair follicles narrowed the field down to 2 genes. One gene, ABCA5, lies in a region implicated in 5 other reported cases of CGHT. Sequencing showed that the mutation found in this patient terminates the gene prematurely. That means that there is a stop codon inserted into the gene that keeps it from finishing the protein being made completely incorrectly. The team determined that the ABCA5 protein, a cholesterol transporter gene, was expressed in control human skin and hair follicles, but was greatly reduced in the patient's hair follicles and skin. It turns out that ABCA5 mutation reduces lysosome function in skin cells, leading to an accumulation of cholesterol inside the endolysosome, preventing it from getting where it needs to go in the cell. If you don't remember, the lysosome is the garbage dump of the cell. It's essentially a sack filled with dozens of enzymes that degrade every known type of biological molecule for recycling and reuse in the cell. So what they found is that cholesterol is building up inside the cells of the affected person where it should not be building up at all. Cristiano says, quote, "We don't know yet the exact mechanism by which ABCA5 affects hair growth, but we hypothesize that it is interfering with cholesterol transport, which is key to many cellular functions that may be important. At the moment, this discovery in itself does not provide an obvious new way to treat hair diseases. However, every time a new gene is implicated in hair growth, it enhances our understanding of the hair cycle, and therefore always helps to expand our thinking about ways to treat both excessive hair as well as sparse hair." Unquote. It's very nice that for once someone is worried about too much hair, but, well, I suspect whether Dr. Cristiano figures it out or not, there's probably little hope for all of us grown-up descendants of Southern Europeans who have just a bit too much hirsuteness. At any rate, next story. Whenever I teach a basic biology class, I always include some basic neurobiology in the class. The discussion includes neurotransmitters and their functions. Now, a neurotransmitter is a chemical, it's a signal, that passes between nerves and either helps or hinders the neuron to fire. Neurotransmitters tend to be quite specific for binding to their own receptors and engendering a precise neurological response. One of the most interesting of these transmitters are the endorphins. Endorphins are opioids made by the central nervous system and have an inhibitory effect on pain receptors. They promote relaxation, like morphine does artificially, and reduce pain during processes like childbirth. Also, it's thought that the so-called runner's high is induced by endorphins, that is, that euphoric feeling that many runners get during long races. Endorphin release has also been linked to eating very spicy foods, which may explain chili heads like myself, who actually try to trigger that release by eating chili peppers with higher and higher capsaicin levels, much to our own detriment. So why am I going on about endorphins? Well, because we get a pleasurable feeling from the rush, like runners or chili heads, many people become addicted to the triggers. In a way, this is similar to why people get addicted to other opiates like morphine or heroin, which bind to the same neurological receptors. In the June 19th issue of the journal Cell, Dr. David Fisher and company from Harvard Medical School have found that perhaps addiction to endorphins may lead to other human behaviors as well. Now, I have to admit that for years I have wondered why sunbathers bake themselves in the heat. I am not fond of the sun or the heat, despite my Southern European heritage. I'm much happier in the cold and frigidity of the north, thanks very much. So it's a mystery to me why anyone would do that to themselves, besides the fact that it turns your skin into leather and may cause cancer if you spend enough time out there. Dr. Fisher may have an answer. Well, it turns out that as John Denver sang, "Sunshine almost always makes me high," may not just be a line from a song. Ultraviolet light causes mice to churn out an opiate-like molecule, beta endorphin, and that may explain why some people seem addicted to tanning. This result may also explain why people are more generally drawn to sunny spots for vacations and do not spend a lot of time in rain and snow-soaked places like Rochester, New York, or Rochester, Minnesota, for that matter. Fisher states, quote, "Do you know why people go to the beach on vacation? Why they put Disneyland in Florida and not in Minnesota, where it's cooler? Why caves are not more popular as a tourist destination? It's all because of what we studied," unquote. Fisher started his studies trying to figure out why skin cancer rates were increasing, even though the cause, UV light from the sun and tanning booths, had been known for years. In an effort to figure out why humans might continue to irradiate themselves, even when warned, he exposed shaved mice to a moderate amount of UV radiation for 5 days a week for 6 weeks. The exposure was comparable to what a fair-skinned person would receive from 20 to 30 minutes of summer sun in Florida. After about a week, the UV-exposed mice had higher levels of beta endorphin. 7 days after the mice stopped the UV treatment, the beta endorphin levels fell to baseline. The endorphin boost was found in the mice's actual blood and not just in the skin, as earlier work had suggested. Endorphins circulating in the blood are able to carry that feel-good message to the brain. As the beta endorphin levels rose, so did the mice's ability to withstand pain. After UV treatment, mice could tolerate a stronger poke on the paw and kept their paw on a hot plate for longer. The control mice, who were bred so that they did not produce beta endorphins, did not respond to UV light in the same way. If they block the effects of the beta endorphin with the drug naloxone, the same drug used to treat heroin overdoses, the mice's pain threshold did not increase. That suggests that these UV effects depend on the production of the endorphins. What's more, mice got addicted to high levels of beta endorphins. After getting used to regular doses of UV light, mice actually showed signs of withdrawal when their endorphin effects were silenced with naloxone. The animals' paws trembled, their teeth chattered, and they shook like wet dogs, quote-unquote. UV-treated mice also avoided a room in which they had previously received naloxone. Control mice that weren't exposed to UV light did not seem to go through naloxone-related withdrawal and didn't avoid the room where the naloxone was administered. Fisher warns that, quote, "This seems to be a clear biological explanation of why some people crave sun. It should prompt policymakers to subject tanning salons to tougher regulations. Membership policies that offer discounts on multiple sessions, for instance, should be discouraged. They say, we'll give you your first 10 treatments for pennies, and then you're hooked. You're literally hooked. It's a great business model, but a devastating public health one," unquote. You could argue that we are not talking about addiction here at all, but a physiological requirement. We could be looking at a biological imperative brought about by evolution. Why spend time in the sun? Because we need to. Vitamin D production is driven by exposure to sunlight. Vitamin D is absolutely needed for our health. Without it, we get rickets. And some researchers, as I have reported in the past, believe that low levels of vitamin D increase skin cancer incidence. Now, I'm speculating here, but imagine evolutionary selection among mammals. Those animals that spent enough time in the sun survived, and those who did not died young and did not reproduce. It makes sense that physiologically, mammals might get rewarded for spending time in the sun, just as they are rewarded for, well, other physiological acts. The next story is another one of those world records that I try to sneak in here from time to time. In the June 19th issue of the journal Nature, it was reported by Dr. Anders Nilsson of the SLOC National Accelerator Laboratory that they had found the lowest temperature that ordinary water has ever been detected in the liquid phase. I always tell my cell biology classes that water's odd properties make it special for life. Unlike most substances, water is denser in the liquid form than as a solid, which allows aquatic creatures to survive in pockets of liquid beneath the frozen surface of a lake. Water has other properties, including its ability to absorb heat and low compressibility. These both change suddenly at very low temperatures. Though water usually freezes at 0 degrees centigrade, pure water can remain liquid well below that temperature. This so-called supercooled water looks just like water from the tap, but it's far more delicate. It solidifies the moment it encounters a foreign substance, such as a grain of dust, an ice cube tray, or the window of a cruising airliner. Past experiments had detected liquid water at minus 38 degrees Celsius, but not colder. Despite scientists' suspicions that it could subsist for measurable periods of time at even lower temperatures. To keep water cold and uncontaminated, Nilsen squirted microscopic water droplets the size of red blood cells into a vacuum chamber. As each droplet traveled, some of its component molecules evaporated, releasing heat and causing the droplet's temperature to plummet as much as 10 degrees per millisecond. As the supercooled droplets journeyed through the chamber, the researchers used an X-ray laser to serve as a flash camera. The laser zapped ultra-short pulses of 50 millionths of a billionth of a second that struck some of the droplets. The laser energy caused each zapped droplet to explode, but not before X-rays had passed through and delivered the equivalent of a medical scan to a detector. The results revealed that some of the droplets existed in liquid form at temperatures as low as minus 46 degrees centigrade and could remain in that state for about a millisecond before freezing. There is your new world record. Nilsen also found that water's weirdness gets more extreme as the temperature drops farther. He says, quote, "It's been proposed that supercooled water undergoes a phase change at about minus 50 degrees centigrade into two never-before-observed liquid states. One of those novel phases should exist only when water is under pressure. We next plan to subject the droplets to a combination of low temperature and high pressure to try to observe these dual phases." Unquote. The next story of the evening has to do with, self-medication. Self-medication and its genetics, actually. Now, I'm an admitted fan of New Jersey-born movie director Kevin Smith. When, say, I rent one of his movies or listen to one of his many podcasts with an earshot, my wife gives me a look reserved for pedophiles and Nazis. She is not a fan of the director for a number of reasons, including Smith's rather free use of language, his strange homoerotic mocking sense of humor, and at times perverse sense of honesty about his sexual exploits. Smith is also a major proponent of the use of marijuana for recreational purposes. I think my wife objects to just how vocal Smith is in this area. I'm pretty sure it's not because he is simply a user, but that he encourages others. I suspect this because my wife is a country music fan and loves Willie Nelson, overlooking his similar proclivity toward weed, presumably because he does not advertise it quite so actively as Smith does. At this point, you're thinking, yeah, that's very interesting. But is there a point to your rambling about famous recreational drug users? And why haven't you mentioned Woody Harrelson and Snoop Dogg? Or is it Snoop Lion now? Anyway, for a long time, there has been some evidence that long-term marijuana use may induce schizophrenia. I even remember hearing this in health class back when I was a kid. So it has been an accepted truth for a while. New work has been published this month in the journal Molecular Psychiatry that examines whether pot use actually does make you crazy or not. Dr. Robert Power, a psychiatrist at King's College London, decided to use a polygenic scoring method in a large genetic sample, that is, the Australian Twin Registry dataset. Basically, the idea is, does genetics play a role in the link between schizophrenia and pot use? Another way to ask this question is, does regular cannabis use cause schizophrenia, as suggested in my health class decades ago? Or do the genes involved in schizophrenia risk just happen to increase the risk of drug use? Power said, quote, "Our approach focuses less on using specific identified genes, but instead sums across the genome thousands of genetic markers we know to be more common in schizophrenia patients compared to controls. Overall, it allows us to get a score for an individual's genetic predisposition to the disease. We then compared that score with two measures of cannabis use, whether an individual had ever used cannabis or not, and if so, how much did they use?" Unquote. The study found that both the use and quantity of pot were found to be positively associated with that score. That result suggests a shared genetic etiology across the summed variants. While this association suggests that a predisposition to schizophrenia may lead to more drug use, there's still much debate about the relationship. Power continued with, quote, "It's probably not that the most common link is shared genetics, despite our findings. After all, we know that an individual is born with their genes. They get them at conception. And so we can use this as an anchor for causation, since we can be a bit more sure that the genes for schizophrenia come first, and then cannabis use comes after that. But with schizophrenia itself, it's hard to tell whether the symptoms started to appear before or after the drug use." Unquote. Here's the thing that's confusing by this study. At least according to Power, it's still unclear whether marijuana may cause schizophrenia, but it also seems like being predisposed to schizophrenia makes you more likely to use pot, leading to cause and effect both ways. If you think about the famous people who use pot heavily, it certainly makes it clear that the latter may be true. They may be self-medicating to ease their ability to cope. Power concludes with, quote, "I think the most interesting part of our study is the reminder that we don't randomly stumble across our environments. We have innate preferences and behaviors that cause us to seek out things like cannabis. This is important when it comes to interpreting genetic studies because it means that sometimes our genes act through predisposing us to those environments. So we shouldn't be too deterministic when we are trying to say just how our genes are influencing us," unquote. In short, Dr. Powers says, we should not think of ourselves as genetic robots, but at the same time, he suggests that our genetics and environment may push us to make decisions that we don't consciously make. Talk about confusing. The last story of the evening is a very surprising one for anybody who has taken any geology or astrophysical sciences classes, or even those of us who have not. My wife actually pointed this one out to me, and we had this conversation. Wife, offhandedly. "I just emailed you a science story." Me. "Great, what's it about?" Wife. "Well, scientists just found out there's an ocean in the mantle of the Earth with more water in it than all the oceans on the surface put together." Me. Confused. "Huh? How's that possible?" Wife. "I don't know. Read the paper." Me. "But the Earth has a solid mantle. There's no place for any water to go." Wife, annoyed. "I told you, Jim, I don't know. Read the paper." Me. "But it's so hot in the mantle that the water would vaporize, wouldn't it?" Wife, now really annoyed. "Just read the paper, will you?" Me. "Yeah, but is this like in Jules Verne's stories and..." Voice trailing off as I notice the chilling look I'm getting. "Okay, maybe I'll just go read the paper." Well, here's the deal. Geophysicist Dr. Stephen Jacobson from Northwestern University authored a study just published in the journal Science that reports that a vast reservoir of water, enough to fill the Earth's oceans three times over, may be trapped hundreds of miles beneath the surface, potentially transforming our understanding of how the planet was formed. The water is not a liquid ocean sloshing around hundreds of miles under our feet, though, a la Jules Verne and Journey to the Center of the Earth. The water is locked up in a mineral called ringwoodite, about 660 kilometers, 400 miles, beneath the crust of the Earth. Even more interesting, the discovery suggests that the Earth's water may have come from within, driven to the surface by geological activity, rather than being deposited by icy comets hitting the forming planet, as held by the prevailing theories presently. Jacobson says, quote, "Geological processes on the Earth's surface, such as earthquakes or erupting volcanoes, are an expression of what is going on inside the Earth out of our sight. I think we are finally seeing evidence for a whole Earth water cycle, which may help explain the vast amounts of liquid water on the surface of our habitable planet. Scientists have been looking for this missing deep water for decades," unquote. Jacobson is the first to provide direct evidence that there may be water in an area of the Earth's mantle known as the transition zone. His group based their findings on a study of a vast underground region extending across most of the interior of the U.S. The mineral, ringwoodite, acts like a sponge due to a crystal structure that makes it attract hydrogen and trap water. According to the study, if just 1% of the weight of mantle rock located in the transition zone has water in it, it would be equivalent to nearly 3 times the amount of water in our oceans. The study used data from the U.S. Array, a network of seismometers across the U.S. that measure the vibrations of earthquakes. Jacobson combined this with his lab experiments on rocks simulating the high pressures found more than 600 kilometers underground. It produced evidence that melting and movement of rock in the transition zone, hundreds of kilometers down between the upper and lower mantles, led to a process where water could become fused and trapped in the rock. The discovery is remarkable because most melting in the mantle was previously thought to occur at a much shallower distance, maybe 80 kilometers beneath the Earth's surface. Jacobson says, quote, "The hidden water might also act as a buffer for the oceans on the surface. It may explain why our oceans have stayed the same size for millions of years. If the stored water wasn't there, it would be on the surface of the Earth, and mountaintops would be the only land poking out," unquote. That comment about flooding brings up some interesting questions. I wonder whether that might not be an explanation for the universal flood stories that pervade so many cultures on Earth, such as that of Noah. Perhaps at one time the world was not as balanced as it is now, and a great deal of more water covered the surface up to the mountains. It's an interesting hypothesis. Here's another idea. Who's to say that there is not a similar layer of water trapped below the Martian soil? Imagine the possibilities for terraforming if there are oceans of water already trapped beneath that dry wasteland of the Martian surface. This is obviously pure speculation, but if Mars ever had free water and oceans, then it could possibly still be down there, trapped, just as it is here. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Remember to take those free tanning booth offers very seriously. Watch that pot use if you aren't schizophrenic to start with, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.